characteristics of the judicial process. The Gideon case demonstrated those characteristics. One is the tendency of courts to focus their attention on individual human beings, in this case Gideon. Legislatures necessarily deal in abstractions, usually large abstractions, which is very different from consideration in terms of the impact on an individual. As a general proposition, it may seem desirable to enact a statute requiring the deportation of aliens who once belonged to the Communist Party. But when that law is applied to a particular person who is 52 years old, who came to this country as an infant of 6 months and joined the party briefly during the Depression, the moral considerations seem very different. The court is forbidden by the Constitution to consider anything but concrete cases involving the real interests of particular litigants. In a civilization growing less human all the time, with budgets beyond the grasp of men and weapons that can wipe out continents, surely there is a special value in an institution that focuses on the individual. In comparison with the other agencies of government, the court also retains an intimate and non-institutionalized character. It does its own work, in Brandeis's phrase, and every justice bears personal responsibility for what is done. Why this characteristic of the judicial process is important is hard to explain, but anyone who has ever tried to grope his way through the faceless bureaucracy of government and pin down responsibility for a mistake will understand. The obstacles to bringing about a change in governmental policy are symbolized in the traditional defeatist question, "Why fight City Hall?" But in the Supreme Court, even Clarence Earl Gideon can freely seek re-examination of past positions, and counsel arguing a case has the most direct and personal opportunity conceivable to reach the minds and hearts of those who decide. Argument itself reflects the distinctions of the judicial process. It is so much more concentrated and intellectually focused than, for example, a legislative debate. At its best, a Supreme Court argument can be as searching and uninhibited an examination of an intellectual problem as is found in Washington. In congressional hearings or debates, the real issue often seems, to the listener's frustration, to be around the corner. In the Supreme Court, justices and counsel can deal directly, in the curiously intimate way that so surprised Bruce Jacob, with the heart of a problem. This is not to say that the court's way of doing things is better than the legislator's, only that it is different. The diffused, discursive methods of the legislature reflect the fact that its decisions must be political, reflecting compromises and accommodations of interests that may be concerned with issues entirely apart from the one under consideration. But of Supreme Court justices, we demand a process of reason. They must not be legislators, engaged in political bargaining, but lawyers, reasoning by analogy from limited materials, creating the new from the old, shaping experience and ideals into workable principle. The search for principle is the essence of the judicial process. It can never be enough for a court to say, as a legislature properly can, X wins the case because he has more votes behind him. Especially in the Supreme Court, which must find in the vague words of our fundamental law the guideposts for a nation, every decision should be supported by reasons that appeal to the intellect and to the ethical sense of Americans. The requirement that a court give reasons for its judgments is a basic safeguard, as the country began to realize belatedly during that shameful era when men were labeled security risks by boards of quasi-judges who gave no reasons at all and thus avoided responsibility for their conclusions. Professor Arthur L. Goodhart, an American who became an English lawyer, master of University College, Oxford, and a great interpreter of the Anglo-American legal tradition, sees in that tradition three great protections against arbitrariness. The judges sit in open court. There is no secret evidence and no secret arguments to which they can listen. The judges give reasons publicly for their judgments. The judges act not as a body, but as individuals. Each one is free to dissent. They are thus each other's severest critics. Professor Goodhart's three points might be restated as one aspect of what distinguishes the Supreme Court's process from a legislature's. Each justice is personally responsible for decisions that must be based on principle openly argued to the court and persuasively reasoned in an opinion. Supreme Court justices are enabled to search for principle free from the political passions of the moment by one of the wise borrowings in our Constitution from English practice. They shall hold their offices, the Constitution says, during good behavior, which as a practical matter means as long as they can and wish to, since impeachment is so remote a prospect. The freedom to decide as one's conscience and intellect demand, without fear of political retribution, is a rare luxury for any office holder, and it certainly helps to explain what happens to men when they don the robes of a Supreme Court justice. The Southern senator required to go through the motions of defending segregation, and many in the Senate today are only going through the motions, can shed that dispiriting burden if he goes on the bench. The state judge, who has to look to political bosses for re-election, as many do, cuts that tie upon appointment to the Supreme Court. The independence given to the justices enables them to do things that others know are right, but have never had the courage or the determination to do by themselves. Shortly before the Gideon case was decided, Abe Fortas was having lunch in the Supreme Court cafeteria with an eminent lawyer from Pennsylvania, the largest state without a requirement for appointment of counsel in all felony cases. "I've told the lawyers of my state and the officials again and again that they should make the appointment of counsel compulsory," the Pennsylvania lawyer said. "They all know it in their hearts, but regardless of their personal or professional convictions, they won't move until this great institution tells them to." Just as life tenure protects the justices from political pressures, so are they cut loose from regional influences. No man can escape, or should, his background and experience, but a Supreme Court justice is more likely than most to outgrow parochial prejudices. And it is increasingly important to have a national voice speaking out on questions such as that posed by the Gideon case. We live under a federal system, with the states retaining a large degree of independence, but we have become a nation. Most of us think of ourselves first as Americans, not as, say, Floridians. And we are a nation with a world responsibility. Justice Schaefer of Illinois has advanced the relation of the United States to the rest of the world, today, as one argument for national standards of criminal procedure. "The quality of a nation's civilization," he wrote, "can be largely measured by the methods it uses in the enforcement of its criminal law. That measurement is taken from day to day by the peoples of the world, and to them the criminal procedure sanctioned by any of our states is the procedure sanctioned by the United States." Apart from what other countries may think, more and more Americans have a national conscience that is troubled by unfairness in law enforcement in any state, or by any state's racial discrimination. It is no longer possible for Mississippi to go her own way without disturbing not only the image the United States projects to the outside world, but the one it projects to itself. And the Supreme Court is in a strategic position to give voice to national ideals. Even the Congress of the United States is deeply affected by regional allegiances. Of all this country's governmental instruments, only the presidency and the Supreme Court are wholly free of sectional ties, and only the court is given the function of regularly measuring state and local policy against the national standards of the Constitution. It is no exaggeration to say, as Holmes did, that the United States might not survive as a nation without the unifying power of the Supreme Court. Nor is the job finished. At almost every term of the Supreme Court, some community claims the right to put a restriction on interstate commerce, or outlaw some book or movie accepted by the rest of the country. It is the court's duty to preserve a union, one without tariff walls or ideological walls, between the states. Professor Goodhart has said that the Supreme Court confronts problems more important and more difficult than any other court in the history of the world has had to face. A justice brings to the task only his character, his intellect, his education, his experience, his human understanding, his imagination. There are really no mysteries, No one teaches a course on how to be a Supreme Court justice. The court is not a place for experts or for specialists. Indeed, it stands for the proposition that it is wise to have the final decisions made by generalists, not specialists. Rather than let tax experts have the last word on tax law, and criminal law specialists the last in their field, with all the ferocious quibbles that experts can produce, we deliberately arrange for an infusion of common sense. Perhaps that is the ultimate curiosity of the Supreme Court, that it must have a sense of our society's common understandings, that it cannot cut itself off from the people. Discussing the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, Justice Frankfurter wrote once that it was the Supreme Court's duty to ascertain the conscience of society. That could not properly be a suggestion that the court finds some minimum level of acceptability by an intuitive public opinion poll. The court's function is not to reflect mass ideas, but to lead enlightened opinion, to educate. At its best, the court is a great teacher, illuminating issues and then drawing support for further steps from the more sensitive public attitudes it has helped to create. When the school segregation case was decided in 1954, the largest part of public opinion in this country was at best inert on the racial question. The man in the street did not feel its ethical imperative. It was only when the ugly face of racism showed itself at Little Rock and elsewhere that Americans saw the moral issue in racial segregation and began to give the court's decision the support it needed to become effective. Yet when it made the choice in 1954, the court surely chose correctly. In the long run, Americans could not have accepted the principle that separation of human beings on account of the color of their skins satisfied the demand for equal protection of the laws. After Adolf Hitler, the world knew that racial separation was an expression not of equality, but of hatred. The relationship between the court and society is just as significant in the area of the Gideon case, criminal law. In its steady march toward higher standards of fairness in criminal procedure, the court was not reflecting popular ideas. The public was probably uninformed and unconcerned about the issues in particular cases. But taken as a whole, the movement was followed and supported by enlightened opinion. Between Powell v. Alabama in 1932 and Gideon v. Wainwright in 1963, there surely developed an overwhelming acceptance of the proposition that states' rights should not include the right to ignore civilized decencies in the enforcement of the criminal law. Court and country were both part of a larger phenomenon. The experiences of totalitarian brutality through which the world had passed since 1932 had made the citizens of many lands more sensitive to the danger of unrestrained official authority. Justice Black took note of this in his opinion in Chambers v. Florida in 1940. "Today, as in ages past," he said, "we are not without tragic proof that the exalted power of some governments to punish manufactured crime dictatorially is the handmaid of tyranny." Professor Allen, looking back at the course of the Supreme Court's criminal law decisions, wrote, "Perhaps it may be worth observing that the decision of the Powell case and the rise of Hitler to power in Germany occurred within the period of a single year. It would, of course, be facile and specious to suggest that these two events are related by any direct, casual connection. Yet, in some larger sense, the two occurrences may be located in the same current of history. Both events are encompassed in the crisis of individual liberty which has confronted the Western world since the First World War. The court has been sensitive to the crisis and has responded emphatically to it. It is not only in the state criminal cases that constitutional doctrine has expanded at a remarkable rate. Virtually all of the law of free speech, assembly, and press, for example, has been articulated in the last 40 years. When viewed against a background of such momentous events, a little criminal case involving the misbehavior of local police officers may take on a peculiar significance. A century ago, de Tocqueville said of the justices of the Supreme Court, "Their power is enormous, but it is the power of public opinion." What is given to the justices is the opportunity not to command, but to persuade. The eloquence of a Brandeis, the ability to perceive great moral truths and to articulate them in a way that excites the imagination of the citizen, is as important to the Supreme Court as the power of sword or purse to the other branches of government. When the court in history has lost touch with the true current of American life, it has only damaged itself. A court that thought it knew best said in the Dred Scott case that Congress had no constitutional power to forbid slavery in new territories. Another said that a state could not limit Baker's work to 10 hours a day. Those decisions turned to dust because they sought to enshrine as eternal principles the prejudices and limited economic understandings of mere men. That is the risk the Supreme Court takes, the risk of failure. When Betts v. Brady was decided in 1942, the majority of the court thought it was expressing a meaningful principle. But trial and error, the case-by-case process of the courts, showed that the Betts rule did not work, that it expressed no principle. When the court in Gideon laid down the universal requirement of counsel, it was only articulating a principle that most of those with an opinion, lawyers, judges, state officials themselves, had already recognized. Gideon v. Wainwright was a triumph for Hugo Black, but in a way, the case suggests that there was not always so deep a gulf between his view of the law and Felix Frankfurter's as the occasional ferocity of their well-known debate suggested. Although he speaks of absolutes, Justice Black has actually dealt with the Constitution as a living document, changing his views as conditions have changed. One of his able disciples, Professor Charles A. Reich of the Yale Law School, a former law clerk to him, has written that Justice Black's opinions during a quarter century on the court reflect an unstated assumption that the Constitution's protections of individual liberty must grow just as the powers of government have been allowed to expand to meet new problems. The issue of the right to counsel, in fact, does not fit Justice Black's public position that history provides satisfactory guides to the meaning of the Constitution. The Sixth Amendment was designed by its framers to assure the right to be represented by counsel to those who could afford to retain their own. But that history rightly presented no obstacle to Justice Black when he wrote Johnson v. Zerbst for the court in 1938, holding that the Sixth Amendment required the federal government to provide in its courts a lawyer for any defendant who was too poor to hire one himself and who did not waive the right. And in Gideon, Justice Black's opinion rested not on absolutes, but on the single proposition that the right to counsel provided by the Sixth Amendment was fundamental and was therefore embraced in the 14th Amendment. Justice Frankfurter was just as dedicated to fair criminal procedure as Justice Black. It was Justice Frankfurter who wrote, in a federal criminal case, "The history of liberty is largely the history of the observance of procedural safeguards." His deep belief in federalism made him draw back from imposing identical requirements on the states, but even there, his difference with Justice Black, for all the talk, may often have come down to a question of timing. In 1942, Justice Frankfurter might have said, "The country was not ready for a universal requirement of counsel in serious criminal cases. The bar was not prepared for such a burden. The states would have resisted, and the decision would have been widely ignored." But that would not have ended the matter for Justice Frankfurter. It is of the very nature of a free society to advance in its standards of what is deemed reasonable and right, he once wrote. Representing as it does a living principle, due process is not confined within a permanent catalogue of what may at a given time be deemed the limits or essentials of fundamental rights. Shortly after the Gideon case was decided, Justice Black visited Justice Frankfurter at home and told his ailing colleague about the conference at which the case had been discussed. He had told the other members of the court, Justice Black said, that if Felix had been there, he would have voted, faithful to his own view of due process, to reverse the conviction of Clarence Earl Gideon and overrule Betts v. Brady. Justice Frankfurter said, "Of course I would." Epilogue. Resolution of the great constitutional question in Gideon v. Wainwright did not decide the fate of Clarence Earl Gideon. He was now entitled to a new trial with a lawyer. Was he guilty of breaking into the Bay Harbor pool room? The verdict would not set any legal precedents, but there is significance in the human beings who make constitutional law cases as well as in the law. And in this case, there was the interesting question whether the legal assistance for which Gideon had fought so hard would make any difference to him. Soon after the decision, Abe Fortas wrote Gideon, suggesting that in the future a local Florida lawyer should represent him. Fortas said he had written to a Florida Civil Liberties Union attorney about the case. This lawyer was Tobias Simon of Miami, who had signed the amicus brief presented to the Supreme Court by the American Civil Liberties Union. Gideon, who before the decision had expressed the hope that the ACLU would give him a lawyer, wrote Simon on April 9, 1963. I humbly am asking you for any help that you can give me in the present situation, Gideon said, because no one knows any better than me of what I am up against. I have no reason to believe now that I would receive a fair trial in the same court than I did before, even with a court-appointed attorney. I have my plea all ready to make, but it probably will be denied me. Simon replied on April 15th that someone from the Civil Liberties Union would represent him at his new trial. Gideon acknowledged that letter with thanks on April 29th, adding that he wondered how long the Supreme Court of Florida would take to act on his case, now, without becoming contemptible of the United States Supreme Court. A few days later, Simon went to Rayford and interviewed Gideon for an hour and a half. He found Gideon to be an irascible but spunky white male. Gideon spoke even more forcefully than in his letters. He was under the illusion that a new trial would constitute double jeopardy, and that the Florida Supreme Court should already have released him outright. A new trial won by a prisoner as a result of his own appeal is not double jeopardy under American law. He said he could never get a fair trial in Panama City, and when Simon tried to reassure him, Gideon became exceedingly bitter and refused to discuss his case any further. But he did agree that we would be able to represent him in the forthcoming new trial, Simon reported to the ACLU. The Florida Supreme Court had received the official notice of the United States Supreme Court decision, the mandate, in April, and on May 15th, it issued an order entitling Gideon to a new trial. The Circuit Court of Bay County set July 5th as the trial date. On July 4th, Simon went to Panama City with Irwin J. Block, an experienced criminal lawyer, until recently the chief assistant prosecutor in Miami, who had agreed to help him. They interviewed some witnesses and former neighbors of Gideon, who seemed to have admiration for a man who fought so hard against odds so great. Then they went to see Gideon, who had been brought from Rayford to the local jail. Mr. Simon described the meeting. Gideon refused to be represented by either of us. He refused to be tried. He stated that the court had no power to try him, and that his trial in Panama City would only mean his return to the penitentiary. All efforts to calm him and to have him place some trust in us failed. The next morning, the time set for trial, Simon and Block met with the prosecutors in the chambers of Robert L. McCrary, Jr., the judge who had presided over Gideon's first trial and was to handle the second. Gideon was also present. Judge McCrary began by noting that Simon had signed some papers and was appearing as defense counsel. I didn't authorize Mr. Simon to sign anything for me, Gideon said. I'll do my own signing. I do not want him to represent me. Judge McCrary asked warily, Do you want another lawyer to represent you? No, said Gideon. After a pause, he added, And I'm not ready for trial. There must have been a touch of bewilderment in the judge's next question. What do you want, then? I want to file for an order to move my case from this court, Gideon replied. I can't get a fair trial in this court. It's the same court, the same judge, everything, and everybody connected with the court is the same as it was before, and I can't get a fair trial here. You're not even going to let me plead my case. At this point, Simon explained his position in the case, reading to the judge, among other documents, Gideon's letter humbly asking for help. But Simon said that of course he and Block did not want to represent Gideon if he did not want them. Gideon repeated his wish. I want to plead my own case. I want to make my own plea. I do not want them to make any plea for me. You don't want Mr. Simon and Mr. Block to represent you? Judge McCrary asked, making absolutely certain that all this was really happening. No, said Gideon. I don't want them to represent me. I do not want them. The court reporter used capitals. The judge excused Simon and Block, but he also made clear that under no circumstances did he want Gideon to try his own case again. After ascertaining that Gideon had no money to hire a lawyer of his own choice, Judge McCrary asked whether there was a local lawyer whom Gideon would like to represent him. There was, W. Fred Turner. For the record, Judge McCrary said quickly, I am going to appoint Mr. Fred Turner to represent this defendant, Clarence Earl Gideon. A member of the prosecuting staff suggested that the public defender just appointed for that judicial circuit under the new Florida public defender law assist Fred Turner. I don't want him in it, Gideon said, evidently preferring a private attorney with no touch of welfare. The judge said, We will just let Mr. Turner handle this case. Then he advised Gideon to get in touch with his new lawyer to file any motions he desired. I want to file my own motions, Gideon said. If this is to be a matter of just sending me back to the penitentiary, I want to do it my own way. It has been more than 2 years now since this crime is alleged to have been committed, and if I'm going back to the penitentiary for the same crime, I want to do it my way. I want to file my own motions. He pulled from his hip pocket two crumpled pages, typewritten single-spaced, that were the motions he had prepared. Judge McCrary asked Gideon to read them to the court reporter. The motions were full of legalistic language, and Gideon seemed to have some trouble reading them. Finally, the judge called a short recess to let Gideon look them over before reading them to the stenographer. These long documents made two main points: that a new trial was barred by the rule against double jeopardy and by Florida's 2-year statute of limitations on his alleged crime. The statute of limitations does not, in fact, apply when an appeal results in a new trial. Judge McCrary listened attentively during the reading of the motions and said he would rule on them later. Then he set a new trial date, August 5th, exactly 1 month later. The judge offered to free the prisoner on $1,000 bail, but Gideon could not raise it and was returned to the penitentiary. Simon later wrote a report on the episode for the Florida Civil Liberties Union, which he subtitled, How the Florida Civil Liberties Union Wasted $300, and How Two Attorneys Each Traveled Over 1,200 Miles and Killed an Otherwise Perfectly Enjoyable July 4th Weekend. But by the end of the report, his anger seems to have softened. He wrote, It has become almost axiomatic that the great rights which are secured for all of us by the Bill of Rights are constantly tested and retested in the courts by the people who live in the bottom of society's barrel. Thus, many of our freedom of religion cases developed out of efforts by members of small sects to force religious tracts upon people who did not want them. Our freedom of speech cases have developed from the efforts of the police to jail persons who ranted and raved against others, including Catholics, Jews, and Negroes. In the future, the name Gideon will stand for the great principle that the poor are entitled to the same type of justice as are those who are able to afford counsel. It is probably a good thing that it is immaterial and unimportant that Gideon is something of a nut, that his maniacal distrust and suspicion led him to the very borders of insanity. Upon the shoulders of such persons are our great rights carried. Gideon's new lawyer, Fred Turner, wrote to Judge McCrary on July 12th, asking that the trial be postponed 3 weeks. He said there were many, many legal problems in this case, a case once considered so simple that the defendant could be required to try it himself on a few minutes' notice. Judge McCrary refused the postponement. On August 1st, the judge denied a series of motions, including Gideon's own, presented by Turner, to dismiss the charges. Courtroom observers thought Gideon looked pleased at the denial and was looking forward to the new trial. Judge McCrary warned him not to interfere with Turner or try to take over his own defense. The courthouse in Panama City is a large brick building, painted yellow, with peeling white columns. It stands on a rather seedy square set with palms. The courtroom is a simple, good-looking room with pale green walls and seats for about 150. It is air-conditioned, a necessity in Panama City in August. The trial began promptly at 9 a.m. on August 5th. After the sheriff's traditional opening, "God Save the United States of America, the State of Florida, and this honorable court," Judge McCrary read a prayer ending, "And help us to do impartial justice, for Christ's sake. Amen." 48 years old, with black hair, informal and gracious in his dealings with the lawyers, but decisive when necessary, McCrary was not an awesome figure in his robes. To his left and below him was the court reporter, Mrs. Nell P. Heath, a motherly figure with firmly upswept hair and pearl earrings. "I reported this case originally, and I thought it was just another run-of-the-mill case. I never thought that Gideon was different from anyone else, that he would just keep on going and going and going." The prosecution table was just in front of the bench. The original prosecutor, Assistant State Attorney William E. Harris, a tanned, bulky man, again sat there. But this time, indicating the importance the case had acquired, his boss was there too, the State Attorney for the Circuit, J. Frank Adams, a foxy-looking figure in a bow tie, and also another assistant, J. Paul Griffith. The prosecutors seemed confident. Adams said, "If he'd had a lawyer in the first place, he'd have been advised to plead guilty." Judge McCrary announced, "The case of State of Florida versus Clarence Earl Gideon. Is the state ready for trial?" Harris said it was. Turner, who was sitting with Gideon at a table back near the rail that separated the spectators from the trial area, got up without waiting to be asked. "We're ready, Your Honor," he said, enthusiastically rolling a pencil between his two flattened hands. Turner was thin and dapper, reminiscent of Fred Astaire. 41 summers old, he said when asked. Ordinarily, a jury of six is used in Florida. There was a panel of 28 white men in the courtroom. "Why no Negroes? They just don't call any," a local newspaper man explained. The first six men were called forward and questioned first by Harris for possible prejudice. Harris was satisfied with all of them. Then Turner questioned the same six. They said they had no prejudices in the case, and they agreed that they would give the defendant the benefit of any reasonable doubt. Without explanation, Turner excused two of the six. Later, he said, privately, that he had gone over the whole jury list in advance. "You've got to know who they are, what they think," and dropped the two men because he knew that one didn't like alcohol and that the other was a convictor. The jury was sworn just before 10 a.m. Harris made a two-minute opening statement to the effect that the state expected to prove Gideon had broken into the Bay Harbor pool room through a rear window. A witness had seen him inside and in an alley after leaving. Turner waived his right to make an opening statement. Henry Cook, the eyewitness, was the first to take the stand. He turned out to be a sallow-faced youth of 22, with greasy black hair, cut in a pompadour and long sideburns. Under Harris's questioning, he told the same story he had at the first trial. He had come back to Bay Harbor from a dance in Apalachicola, 60 miles away, at 5:30 that morning, and had spotted Gideon inside the pool room. He had followed Gideon down the alley to a telephone booth, then back to the pool room. Gideon's pockets bulged. Turner began his cross-examination by asking who had driven Cook back from Apalachicola that night. When Cook had trouble remembering, Turner suggested some names. Turner had driven to Apalachicola a few days earlier to try, without success, to find the other young men who had been in the car. Cook said the car was an old model Chevrolet. "Why did they put you off two blocks from your home when they'd driven you 60 miles? Turner asked. Cook mumbled inaudibly, then said, "I was going to hang around there till the pool room opened up, 7 o'clock. Turner began addressing the witness with irritation, familiarity. "Well now, Henry," and took him back over the events of that night. Cook said he had had a beer or two, but then the stores had closed in Apalachicola at midnight. This brought Turner back to the question of why Cook and his friends had stopped outside the Bay Harbor pool room. Turner had a suggestion, an accusation. "Mr. Cook," he said, "did you go into the Bay Harbor pool room?"
"No, sir."
"Did you all get a six-pack of beer out of there?"
"No, sir."
Turner led Cook over a detailed discussion of the geography of Bay Harbor and the pool room, indicating an intimate acquaintance with it himself. He had spent a day nosing around Bay Harbor and talking with people to prepare for the trial. Weren't there some advertising boards in the front window? How could Cook have seen past them and spotted Gideon, as he claimed? Weren't the windows on the alley too high to see through? "You did not call the police then or later?" Turner asked. It was as much a comment as a question.
"That's right."
After more questions, Turner asked, "Ever been convicted of a felony?"
"No, sir, not convicted. I stole a car and was put on probation."
That answer set off a long wrangle between the lawyers. At the first trial, when Gideon asked whether he had ever been convicted of a felony, Cook had answered, "No, sir, never have." Turner said that was a false answer that reflected on Cook's character and credibility as a witness. State Attorney Adams popped up and said it was not necessarily false because Cook had evidently pleaded guilty. That was not the same as being convicted. Turner said it was the same. There was a suggestion that the plea might have been in a juvenile court, where there are no formal convictions. Finally, the judge allowed this exchange, which closed the cross-examination. Turner: "Have you ever denied being convicted of a felony?" Cook:
"Yes, sir."
Turner: "When and where did you deny your criminal record?"
Cook: "Right here, at his last trial."
On redirect examination, Harris got Cook to say he had not understood the question about a felony at the first trial. Turner moved to strike this testimony, saying, "I don't think this should go to the jury with any excuses or any embellishments. I don't care if he's ignorant of the law, or I am. That still doesn't change the spots on the leopard. He's a convicted felon." Judge McCrary let Cook's explanation stand, but Turner had made the score he wanted, impressing the jury with Cook's record. The prosecution's second witness was the man who had operated the Bay Harbor pool room, Ira Strickland, Jr., 29 years old, growing bald. He was no longer in the pool room business. Now he was a stock clerk. Questioning him, State Attorney Adams went into much greater detail about the pool room and Gideon's relationship to it than at the first trial. Had Gideon worked for Strickland? Never on the payroll, but he had helped out sometimes. Was he authorized to be in the pool room on the morning of the third day of June, 1961?
No.
On cross-examination, Turner asked whether others had not operated the pool room for Strickland.
Occasionally.
Even this defendant, Gideon, operated it sometimes, didn't he?
Well, occasionally.
There was no further explanation. Turner pressed Strickland to say exactly what he missed from the pool room when he arrived that morning, but Strickland said he could not be precise.
Are you sure there was money in that cigarette machine the night before?
Yes.
How can you be sure? I bought a pack myself.
Shortly before noon, Judge McCrary recessed the trial for lunch. Afterward, the state called the detective who had arrested Gideon in 1961. Dewell Pitts was a square-faced, handsome man, 37 years old, wearing a sports jacket and salmon-colored tie. Like the other prosecution witnesses, he seemed to have no animus toward Gideon. Indeed, he spoke rather gently of him. On direct examination, he testified that he had been called by the policeman who discovered the break-in, was given Gideon's name at the scene by Cook, and arrested Gideon in a downtown Panama City bar the same morning. Under cross-examination, Pitts produced his notes of what Strickland had told him was missing from the pool room that morning. 4/5 of wine, 12 bottles of Coca-Cola, 12 cans of beer, about $5 from the cigarette machine, and $60 from the jukebox. Then Turner asked a question that boomeranged. When you arrested Clarence Earl Gideon that morning,
How much money did he have on him? Pitts answered, $25.28 in quarters, nickels, dimes, and a few pennies. On redirect, that damning point was reemphasized. This $25.28, he had no bills? Not that I remember. Preston Bray, the cab driver who was called by Gideon the morning of the crime and drove him downtown, testified that Gideon had paid him 6 quarters. He said that Gideon had told him, "If anyone asks you where you left me off, you don't know. You haven't seen me." But on cross-examination, he said Gideon had told him the same thing on other occasions. Do you know why? I understand it was his wife. He had trouble with his wife. There were these further exchanges between Turner and Bray. Question. What was his condition as to sobriety? Answer. What's that? Question. Was he drunk or sober? Answer. He was sober. Question. Did he have any wine on him? Answer. No, sir. Question. Any beer? Answer. No, sir. Question. Any Coca-Cola? Answer. No, sir. Question. Did his pockets bulge? Answer. No, sir. That was the prosecution's case. The jury was sent out, and then Turner moved for a directed verdict of acquittal, arguing that the evidence went only to show Gideon in the pool room, not breaking into it. Judge McCrary listened politely, and then said without hesitation, "The motion will be denied. Call the jury back." Turner produced a surprise defense witness who had never appeared in the case before. He was J.D. Henderson, owner of the grocery in Bay Harbor. Between 8 and 9 on the morning of June 3, 1961, Henderson said, Henry Cook had come into his store and told the grocer that the law had picked him up for questioning about the break-in. "Picked who up?" Turner asked with an air of mock disbelief. "Henry Cook." Henderson said Cook had told him about seeing someone in the pool room, but was not sure who it was. He said, "It looked like Mr. Gideon." If such a statement had been made by Cook, it was much less positive than his subsequent testimony. On cross-examination, Harris asked whether Henderson had ever had any trouble with Henry Cook. "No." "Does he owe you any money?" "He owes a grocery bill, $41, for almost a year." The second and last witness for the defense was Clarence Earl Gideon. Question. On the morning of June 3, 1961, did you break and enter the Bay Harbor pool room? Answer. No, sir. Question. What was the purpose of your going into town? Answer. To get me another drink. Question. Where'd you get the money? Answer. I gambled. Question. What kind of games? Answer. Mostly rummy. Question. Did you ever gamble with Henry Cook? Answer. Sure, I gambled with all those boys. Question. Did you have any wine with you? Answer. I don't drink wine. Question. Any beer, any Coke? Answer. No. Question. What did you purchase in town? Answer. I didn't purchase nothing except something to drink. Question. That's what I mean. What did you purchase to drink? Answer. 4 or 5 beers, and I bought a half pint of vodka. Question. What do you say to this charge that you broke and entered the pool hall? Answer. I'm not guilty of it. I know nothing about it. On cross-examination, Harris asked where Gideon was employed at the time. I wasn't employed. I was gambling. There was a long exploration of when Gideon had last held a regular job. He had painted some rooms at the Bay Harbor Hotel and was given free rent, a $6 a week room, in exchange. He had run poker games for Strickland in the pool room. There followed some questions about gambling that Gideon answered with a puzzled air, as if bewildered at Harris's failure to understand. Question. Why did you have all that money in coins? Answer. I've had as much as $100 in my pockets in coins. Question. Why? Answer. Have you ever run a poker game? Question. You would carry $100 in coins around for a couple of days at a time? Answer. Yes, sir. I sure wouldn't leave it in a room at the Bay Harbor Hotel.
Question. Did you play rummy that night?
Answer. No, I was too busy drinking.
Question. Have you ever been convicted or pled guilty to a felony?
Answer. Yes, 5 times, including this one.
At 2:40 p.m., the testimony was all in. Judge McCrary recessed the trial and called the lawyers and Gideon into his chambers to discuss how he should charge the jury. The lawyers wrangled for half an hour, ending with a squabble over how much time they would have for closing arguments. Judge McCrary settled this by allowing each side 45 minutes. As it turned out, neither used that much. In his address to the jury, Turner was the model of the practiced criminal lawyer, dramatic but not too dramatic. His whole argument focused on Henry Cook. "This probationer," he said scornfully, "has been out at a dance drinking beer. He does a peculiar thing when he supposedly sees Gideon inside the pool room. He doesn't call the police, he doesn't notify the owner, he just walks to the corner and walks back, as Cook had testified. What happened to the beer and the wine and the Cokes? I'll tell you. It left there in that old model Chevrolet. The beer ran out at midnight in Apalachicola. Why was Cook walking back and forth? I'll give you the explanation. He was the lookout." Having accused Cook and his friends of actually committing the crime, Turner turned to the defendant. "Gideon's a gambler," he said, "and he'd been drinking whiskey. I submit to you that he did just what he said that morning. He walked out of his hotel and went to that telephone booth to call the cab. Cook saw him, and here was a perfect answer for Cook. He names Gideon." For the state, Assistant Prosecutor Griffith had made a straightforward closing argument, summarizing the testimony without dramatics. Now, in rebuttal to Turner, Harris got a little more folksy.
$25 worth of change," he said. "That's a lot to carry in your pocket. But Mr. Gideon carried $100 worth of change in his pocket."
He paused and raised his eyebrows.
"Do you believe that? There's been no evidence here of any animosity by Cook toward Gideon. There's no evidence here that Cook and his friends took this beer and wine."
The jury went out at 4:20 p.m. after a colorless charge by the judge, including the instruction, requested by Turner, that the jury must believe Gideon guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in order to convict him. When a half hour had passed with no verdict, the prosecutors were less confident. At 5:25, there was a knock on the door between the courtroom and the jury room. The jurors filed in, and the court clerk read their verdict, written on a form. It was not guilty.
"So say you all?"
asked Judge McCrary, without a flicker of emotion. The jurors nodded. Judge McCrary had written of Gideon's first trial, "In my opinion, he did as well as most lawyers could have done in handling his case." But Gideon had not done as well as Fred Turner. He had none of Fred Turner's training, or his talent, or his knowledge of the community. Nor could he prepare the case as Turner had, because he had been in prison before his trial. Turner had spent 3 full days before trial interviewing witnesses and exploring the case. He went out in the backyard and picked pears with Cook's mother to see what he could find out about the prosecution's star witness. Actually, Turner already knew a good deal about Cook because he had twice been Cook's lawyer, a coincidence that was not a great surprise in a small town like Panama City, where part of a lawyer's job is to know everyone. He had represented Cook in a divorce action and defended him successfully against a charge of leading a drunk out of the Bay Harbor pool room, beating him up and robbing him of $1.98. Gideon's insistence on having a local lawyer, Fred Turner, may well have won the case for him. It is doubtful that the Civil Liberties Union lawyers from Miami could have been so effective with a Panama City jury. After nearly 2 years in the state penitentiary, Gideon was a free man. There were tears in his eyes, and he trembled even more than usual as he stood in a circle of well-wishers and discussed his plans. His half-brother, the Air Force sergeant, was coming home from Japan and would adopt Gideon's children.
Gideon would see the children the next day, then go off to stay with a friend in Tallahassee. That night, he would pay a last triumphant visit to the Bay Harbor pool room. Could someone let him have a few dollars? Someone did. "Do you feel like you accomplished something?" a newspaper reporter asked. "Well, I did." This is Robertson Dean. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Gideon's Trumpet, How One Man, a Poor Prisoner, Took His Case to the Supreme Court and Changed the Law of the United States, by Anthony Lewis. This program was directed by Chris Koscheski, executive producer Dan Musselman. Text copyright 1964 by Anthony Lewis. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.